Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Maria Chudnovsky of Columbia University, who just won a MacArthur Genius Fellowship. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy final day of the holiday of Chanukah. I hope you've enjoyed this festival of lights, the latkes and dreidels, the songs and sufganiyot, and even the presents. And now, after 8 days of fried food and parties, it's time to begin to think about cutting back on the caloric intake. Unfortunately, there are other celebrations this time of year that we participate in, and often they also have food to eat, I'm told. The danger is that what we take from this holiday season may turn out to be nothing but several extra pounds around the middle of our bodies. And that would be a shame, because for Jews and non-Jews, the central message of Chanukah is powerful and important, and it is especially relevant all year round, here in America and everywhere in the world. At its heart, Chanukah celebrates religious freedom, the right of conscience, the ability to choose what we believe in and how we wish to express that belief. When our ancestors, the Maccabee-led Jews of the 2nd century BCE, fought against a far more powerful oppressor to assert their right to believe in one God and to serve that God as they saw fit, they struck a powerful blow for religious freedom for everyone. The Seleucid Syrian Greek Hellenistic Empire insisted that everyone worship the deified king as though he were a god, an obligation to practice state-approved religion. When the rebel Jews overthrew the enemy, they did so in order to pray and practice as they believed. They chose to fight and suffer, and often die for that belief, but even more, they fought for the right to hold those beliefs and for others to do so as well. Of course, throughout history, we Jews have often been denied the right to worship God and study Torah, and we have often been forced to fight, and even more often to die, for our belief in one God. We are very well suited to judge which societies truly respect the right of conscience and allow their members to pray and practice as their hearts and minds inspire them to do so. Those places that allowed us to be Jews freely are remembered well. Ancient Persia, the Netherlands after the expulsion from Spain, the Ottoman Empire during that same period, the colony of Rhode Island here in America, founded for religious freedom, even France in the days of the Revolution and under Napoleon. But there aren't too many other examples in history that we can really celebrate, except for America. It is this aspect of Chanukah that resonates so perfectly with our American ideology, if not always our American practice. America was created by people seeking economic opportunity in the absence of domination by powerful aristocracies. But it was also founded by a great number of people whose principal motivation was religious freedom, the ability to pray as they wished. From the Puritans of Massachusetts, who fled persecution in England, to the Catholics in Maryland, whose governor, Lord Baltimore, drafted a toleration act that read, "No person or persons shall from henceforth be in any ways troubled, molested, or discountenanced in respect of his or her religion, nor in the free exercise thereof." There were many bumps along the road to the free exercise of religious freedom in America, of course. The Puritans soon created their own kind of theocracy. The Catholics lost power in Maryland and toleration was repealed for a while, and Quakers were persecuted and fled existing colonies to found Pennsylvania. But the tendency toward inclusion and away from the state forcing religion on anyone or prohibiting the practice of religious freedom, was gradually established. Way back in 1779, Thomas Jefferson, echoing the philosopher John Locke, wrote the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. He said, "No man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burdened in his body or goods, or otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief. All men shall be free to profess, and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities." It's a great statement. There's a reason that Jefferson's friend James Madison wrote in the Bill of Rights to our Constitution that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. You know, freedom of religion has not always been fully supported by the citizens of these United States. The founder of the Mormon faith, Joseph Smith, was murdered by an anti-Latter-day Saints mob in Missouri in 1844. And for many years, we Jews were subject to a great deal of anti-Semitism, both actively hostile and of the more genteel variety. But the official and legal guarantees of religious freedom that are now enshrined in American law and tradition have helped make this a country officially and truly dedicated to the protection of personal conscience and conviction. Hanukkah comes annually to remind us that freedom of religion is a critical component for any just society, and that it is worth defending at nearly any cost. The truth is that free societies are the places where we Jews have flourished, and where all religious minorities flourish, to the benefit of the societies in which they exist. The truth is that free societies are the places where we Jews have flourished, and where all religious minorities have flourished to the benefit of the societies in which they live. Freedom of religion, thought, and conscience are not only morally and ethically good, they are good for the country that protects those freedoms. Smart people want to believe and worship as they choose. And having that freedom is a crucial component to fostering a vibrant, diverse society. And we have the Maccabees to thank for that, and the holiday of Hanukkah to remind us of just how precious that religious freedom is. So, my friends, happy end of Hanukkah, and when you enjoy that freedom to pray and practice as you choose, or to not pray or practice as anyone else demands, thank them. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Professor Maria Chudnovsky of Columbia University, will tell us what it's like to officially be named a genius. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, it's common knowledge that what's large to one person may appear small to another. Take pizza, for example. Some places sell a, quote, large pizza for a pretty large price. Then surprise, you get it home, it barely feeds three people. Some places sell you two large pizzas for the price of one. Believe me, they can't be too large unless they're using real cheap ingredients. But that's a subject for another commercial. Anyway, at Mama's, we think our family-sized pizza should be the yardstick for measuring all pizzas. In fact, you need a yardstick to measure it. The bottom line is that pizza size is all relative. And on behalf of all my relatives, we invite you to Mama's to try one of our pizzas, no matter what size. After all, every Mama's pizza has a taste that's huge. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. You can check them all out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome our guest this morning, Dr. Maria Chudnovsky. She is officially a genius, having received a 2012 MacArthur Fellowship. How does that feel, by the way?
Feels good.
I don't know what else I was expecting, but she has been called the brilliant and distinguished. The Columbia University professor is known for her great strengths in making mathematics applicable to everyday situations, recording relations between objects. She was born in Russia, raised in Israel, completed her undergraduate work at the Technion, served in the IDF for 3 years, and after getting her master's there, came to the U.S., getting her PhD from Princeton. It's nice to be bright. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, how does one receive a MacArthur Fellowship, and what does that mean professionally?
Well, the way you receive it is by a phone call completely out of the blue. This person calls you and starts asking you questions about the MacArthur Foundation and whether you had ever heard about it. And you try not to get your hopes up because maybe they just want a recommendation from somebody else. And then eventually says, did you know you're a MacArthur Fellow? And it's pretty awesome. What it means for me professionally, I'm not sure exactly yet. It's only been a couple of months. I mean, I'm sure it's going to attract a lot of visibility to the area, and I certainly hope, it will do great things to graph theory. I certainly hope more great students will come to Columbia to study with me. Hopefully maybe we'll expand in the field. But I think mostly it's just very good that more people have heard of graph theory now, and we're famous.
So can you explain to the layperson who had maybe not talking about any particular 1 year of college calculus what graph theory is?
What graph theory does, it allows you to model connections between objects. So what a graph is, it has vertices, and then, right, so think of points on a piece of paper. And then some vertices have a connection between them, have a relation between them, and some don't. So, for example, you go to a party, and some people like each other and some people don't. So your vertices are going to be the people at the party, and then a relation means this person and that person like each other. So now we have a mathematical model to describe whether your friends get along. Now, instead of sort of trying to keep in mind a lot of information that maybe doesn't make sense, you have a picture that represents it all. Not only that, you also have generations of mathematicians having worked on what to do with this picture to extract information about it.
Can graph theory predict future relationships as well?
No, it's more of taking the snapshot of now and trying to understand what's going on now.
I've heard that it has applications in operations research in a variety of different areas. Have you begun to plumb those possibilities?
I hear about these things all the time. Most of my work is more theoretical. I don't actually deal with applications. But, I've had some education in my life, so I've learned.
Glad to hear that.
Exactly. So, for example, an application we always give in the first graph theory course, think of a graph where the vertices are cell phone towers. And then you say two vertices are in a relation if the two cell phone towers are close enough together that if they transmit at the same frequency, there will be interference between them. Okay, so that's a graph that describes some real-life situation. Now you need to assign frequencies to the towers to transmit that. You need to make sure that there's no interference, which means if two towers are too close together, you need to give them a different frequency. So that's a graph theory problem. That's called the coloring problem in graph theory.
We will find out a great deal more about graph theory and about Maria Chudnovsky when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, tojewishradio.com, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. You know, Hanukkah is nearly over. It ends at sundown tonight when we actually do not light candles for the first time in 9 days. I know, Hanukkah is only 8 nights. But since it started on a Saturday night and we lit candles the Friday night before, that makes 9 straight nights of candles. Anyway, Hanukkah has all kinds of wonderful and silly music we get to play. However, there are some other songs that never quite made it to the Hanukkah playlist. Here's our Too Jewish list of the top 10 Hanukkah songs that never quite caught on. A drum roll, please. Number 10 on the list of Hanukkah songs that never quite caught on, Oi to the World. Number 9, Schlepping Through a Winter Wonderland. Number 8, Hava Nagila, the Mega Mix. Number 7, Bubby Got Run Over by a Reindeer. Number 6, Enough with the Jingle Bells Already. Number 5, Latka Latka Man by the Lower East Side Village People. Number 4, I Have a Little Dreidel, the Barking Dogs version. Number 3, Come On Baby, Light My Menorah. Number 2, Deck the Halls with Balls of Challah. And the number 1 Hanukkah song that never quite caught on, Silent Night. I Should Be So Lucky. That was our top 10 list of Hanukkah songs that never quite caught on. Here's one that might, however. It's a pretty new Hanukkah song from Michelle Citron about lighting Hanukkah candles left to right, the direction we lit our candles on Hanukkah.
Tonight we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right. Left to right. We celebrate our victory, we celebrate our rights. First you take a single candle and you start it with a spark. Then
then you pass it all around the world, bring light into the dark. Tonight we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right. I said tonight we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right. I said tonight we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right.
Michelle Citrin singing about lighting Hanukkah candles from left to right, a final tribute to the Festival of Lights and religious freedom for the year. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Guy, Israeli so-called settlements are building in various areas that were not originally Israel before 1948, have been controversial in the international community for a long time. There's a lot of different kinds of areas from Israel's perspective. In the recent aftermath of the Palestinian vote to be accepted to member status at the UN, almost reactively, it seemed like, the Netanyahu government announced a whole bunch of 3,000 new building units. Can you just kind of cover the differences of the settlement units and sort of what it means from an Israeli perspective?
Well, first of all, I need to say that I'm not sure that on this specific topic there is one unified Israeli perspective.
On which topic is there one unified Israeli perspective?
Well, on which topic is there one Jewish unified perspective? Anyhow, the latest issue on the table was the program to build 3,000 units at a section called E1, or a program called E1. Now, a lot of American Jewish organizations, including, if I'm not mistaken, the Reform Jewish organization.
Reform movement, right, the URJ.
Condemned that plan. On the other hand, there were voices that actually embraced it, and voices in between. I must admit, I think that most people, including very famous journalists that were very quick to write articles in fancy magazines, are not really familiar with the plan. I need to honestly say, I didn't see in person all the detailed plans, but I did my research, at least to understand what's going on. So maybe we should, instead of saying what our perspective is, let's first understand the details, the facts on the ground. The program for E1 is an area, rather small area, that is located south of the neighborhood of Kiryat Menachem Begin. Kiryat Menachem Begin is one of the major Jewish neighborhoods of Jerusalem. It was constructed at 1956. Despite the fact that it's physically on the east side of Jerusalem, it is considered West Jerusalem. Whoever looks at the line in Jerusalem doesn't really understand what's east and west, because there is no real east and west, as people tend to think.
Clearly a Jewish neighborhood, clearly a large established Jewish neighborhood for 40 years or something, 50 years maybe.
From 1956 and on.
45 years.
Before the Six-Day War, which many people refer to as a critical point. And it's north from the Palestinian village/neighborhood of Abu Dis. Abu Dis, anyone who toured Jerusalem knows that Abu Dis is bordering with the old city of Jerusalem, very close to some of the more significant sites for both Jews, Muslims, and Christians. There were in the past some plans by some of the left-wing parties in Israel to offer Abu Dis as maybe a potential capital city for a future Palestinian state. On the other hand, the area E1 is also the connection between Jerusalem to a city called Ma'ale Edumim. It's a distance of less than 3 miles between Jerusalem and Ma'ale Edumim. Ma'ale Edumim is a large Jewish city that is, if you refer to the Green Line, although I don't think that the Green Line has any real meaning looking historically, but if you do refer to it, Ma'ale Edumim is east to the Green Line. Today, there are 45,000 people living in Ma'ale Edumim. It's a very big Jewish city, and I think it's very clear that Ma'ale Edumim will not be removed from the map
in
any future
negotiations. Right.
So I think when looking at all of that, that gives a different perspective, and each person can judge to one way or the other. The claim against the E1 plan is that once you build all the way from Ma'ale Edomim to Jerusalem, you kind of break significant part of what could be a Palestinian state.
Right.
On the other hand, you ensure Ma'ale Edomim is part of Israel.
Thanks, Guy. Very interesting, tricky issue. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi. We've
been talking about a serious subject, anti-Semitism, the last couple of weeks. Let's talk about it in a kind of a different way. Israel gets slammed about human rights with regard to the Palestinians, but there's a much larger perspective here.
Well, I mean, two things that come to mind about the news coverage of the recent events in Gaza. One is, you know, the classic thing of a handful of Palestinians get killed by Israelis, and there's a huge outcry all over the world in demonstrations and criticism in the press and all that. Regardless of the reason, the fact that, you know, rockets have been fired into Israel cities and people have been killed and they're spending their days, doesn't matter. The fact is, unfortunately, that some Palestinians were killed in these attacks. However, when 50,000 Syrians are killed by fellow Arabs, hardly anyone makes a murmur. So there is clearly a double standard. Israel is held to a higher standard than other states.
I used to work with a rabbi who said, why is it that the world only cares when an Arab is killed by a Jew? If they're killed by another Arab, it doesn't count.
Well, there's a certain amount of truth to that. But the other sense in which Israel is held to a higher standard is it has for many decades been known as the only real democracy in the Middle East, as a country with Western values, and it was conceived that way. And the fact is that if you judge Israel in those terms, it looks pretty good. I recently received, you know, I've been setting up this nonprofit called the International Organization for the Promotion of Tolerance. So in the process of creating this organization, I've gotten on all kinds of mailing lists, and particularly in the social media, I get things that I never would have seen before. And one of them was something like from, I don't know, gayjews.com or something, which was a documentary about the legal situation of the GLBT community in Israel. And it was made by two guys from Berkeley, and it was very impressive. 6 minutes did this wonderful job of showing how far, far superior Israel is in terms of the legal situation of many of its minorities, including women, including the GLBT community, including the handicapped, than any country in the region, including some Mediterranean countries on the southern rim of Europe. So one of the things these guys from Berkeley pointed out is that a lot of Arabs, particularly Palestinians, but others from Jordan, Egypt, whatever, who feel that their lives are constantly endangered as gay men or women in their own countries, move to Tel Aviv, and they'd rather put up with whatever hostility there may be between Arabs and Jews, which is fairly minimal in Tel Aviv, than put up with the life-threatening hostility in their own countries towards gays, lesbians, bisexuals, et cetera, et cetera. So, and it's very interesting if you consider a sort of 360-degree picture of Israel's human rights record, it begins to look a lot better than even the worst propaganda would suggest in terms of how it sometimes treats Palestinians.
It's a great point. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Sunday morning, Sarah decides to take her 4-year-old granddaughter Hannah with her on a visit to the old age home. As soon as she gets there, Hannah's amazed and intrigued by all the old age appliances she sees everywhere. So Sarah explains to her why residents have wheelchairs, walkers, canes, elevating beds, and so on. In one of the rooms they visit, Hannah stops and stares at a pair of false teeth soaking in a glass of water. "So why are you looking at that man's teeth, Bubula?" asks Grandmother Sarah nicely. "What are you thinking of?" "Well, Bubby," Hannah replies, "I'm saying to myself, I don't think the Tooth Fairy will believe it." That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayigash begins with the climax of the great Joseph story that fills the last sections of the book of Genesis. Joseph is now the powerful ruler of Egypt, richest country in the ancient world. His miraculous ascent from slavery and then prison to the heights of political power is the stuff dreams are made of, and he is the master of all he surveys, subservient only to a pharaoh who trusts him completely. He is handsome, rich, hugely powerful, with a wife and 2 fine sons, completely assimilated into Egypt's elegant culture, and still comparatively young. The world sits at his manicured feet. But wait, there's more. For into this idyllic scene blunder Joseph's early tormentors, the very half-brothers who taunted him and beat him up. These are the conniving thugs who stripped and tossed him into a pit in the earth and then sat down to eat lunch, debating in his hearing whether to kill him now or just abandon him to thirst and starvation. And then they sold him into slavery in a foreign land instead. Now, 20 years later or so, he has the opportunity to return the favor, to exact at least a psychological vengeance on these half-brothers. After a sequence of twists and turns, Joseph has manipulated them into a state of confusion and terror, unmanned these arrogant, unruly rural ruffians into a fearful submission. He has had his dish of revenge served cold and seems to have liked it. And then something snaps in Joseph. Perhaps he simply tires of psychologically torturing his half-brothers. Perhaps it is that he has finally seen his full brother Benjamin again, the only living reminder of his dead mother Rachel. Perhaps it's that the fullest measure of revenge is magnanimity. And perhaps it's simply that Joseph's exceptional ability to act pragmatically exerts itself, and he must end the cat-and-mouse game one way or another. Or perhaps it's the stirring confessional speech that his powerful half-brother Judah delivers that brings Joseph to a new place. But near the beginning of Vayigash, in the dramatic high point of the story, Joseph chooses to reunite with his family. He sends out his advisors, counselors, and courtiers. He cries out in a voice loud enough to be heard by all. He tells his brothers that he is Joseph. Weeping now, he embraces his brother Benjamin and asks, "Is my father still alive?" One can scarcely imagine the shock of that moment, even now, perhaps 3,600 years after the events. The brothers may have had an inkling that he was indeed Joseph. It's implied in the text, but the full revelation must have been stunning nonetheless. Their worst fears are realized. They have been and are now completely in the power of a despised half-brother they comprehensively wronged. What now? Joseph moves immediately to reassure them and to relieve their fears, while he gently reminds them that he is the authority now. Everyone will move down to Egypt and live in land he provides. Jacob, his father, comes down to Egypt too. The family is reassembled, but in a very different configuration, for the unquestioned new patriarch is Joseph himself, and the great story will continue in a new land and a new direction. There is something about this story that compels us to examine our assumptions about just how things work in our world. Unpredictable stuff occurs. What we expect is often not what happens. Fate plays a role. And in the best of circumstances, with God's help, our own actions, like Joseph's, may begin with base motivation, yet rise to a level of magnanimity and grace. May this be God's will. May it be ours as well. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Maria Chudnovsky, a Jewish immigrant from Russia to Israel and Israel to the United States, will tell us just what it takes to be named the genius by the MacArthur Foundation. Find out on To Jewish in a moment.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The excellent national Jewish newspaper, The Forward, came out with their annual salary survey, the list of the top earners at all Jewish nonprofits in America. It actually makes for fascinating reading. While none of those employed at Jewish not-for-profits in the U.S. are making over $1 million a year, like the heads of the Boys and Girls Clubs of America or the American Cancer Society, there are still some startling dollar numbers associated with people who are working for your tzedakah. 11 of them make over $500,000 a year, and most of the 75 people on the Forward list make over $275,000 a year. Nice work if you can get it, apparently. The top Jewish philanthropy earner, whose salary is reported, Richard Joel of Yeshiva University, made $879,000 last year. Not quite Major League Baseball player money, but still pretty good. Of note, most of the top 25 super salaries are going to executives of Jewish federations around the United States. The highest of them, Jerry Silverman, president of the Overall Federation Movement, who clocks in at well over $600,000 a year to collect your charity. Chicago, Baltimore, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and a couple of guys in Palm Beach County, two of them, all pull down $400,000 or more. Getting us to give tzedakah to a Jewish umbrella organization with high overhead is apparently a very lucrative gig. It just makes you wonder what or who you are giving money to when you donate to the Federation. Also notable, the top 20 earners in the Jewish philanthropic world, I use that word maybe a little loosely, are all men. Janice Weinman, the head of Hadassah, checked in at about $400,000 a year to lead the women in that category. By the way, the heads of the Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, and Orthodox movement institutions surveyed, by and large, did not report the salaries of their leaders. In other news, addressing one of the most controversial issues in Israeli society today, the senior rabbi of the Lithuanian ultra-Orthodox Haredi community, Rabbi Aharon Leib Steinman, last week announced that yeshiva students should not agree to enlist in national service in Israel. The rabbi's decision, quoted in the Haredi daily newspaper Yatid Ne'eman, came the day after Israel's cabinet approved a temporary law that would allow yeshiva students to perform national service in place of the army. We must warn publicly against this serious and dangerous phenomenon which only aims to destroy the foundations of our existence, against the essence and mission of a yeshiva student to devote his life to studying Torah. Steinman said, "The cabinet's decisions and similar actions are harming the foundations of Judaism," he continued. Steinman's statements appeared in an article inside the newspaper. They were not a signed statement on the front page, as he usually does, showing that perhaps the rabbi is walking a fine line between his own convictions and those of rabbis who have taken an even harder stance in the Haredi community. Steinman has previously backed the formation of an all-Haredi army brigade, and he supported the Tal law exempting the yeshiva students from army service. Steinman's predecessor as leader of the Lithuanian Haredi Orthodox movement, the late Rabbi Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, also rejected national service and other programs geared at the Haredi community. In more positive Orthodox Jewish news from Israel, another prominent Haredi rabbi, Rabbi Yuval Chirlo, the Orthodox head of the Hester Yeshiva in Petah Tikva, one of the heads of the Tzohar Organization of Rabbis and the member of the Takana Forum Board, among many other positions, came back from a trip to the U.S. last week and said that it was now necessary to re-examine the framework of rabbinical law so that Jewish communities abroad would be able to absorb more Jews who are not religiously observant. He called on Israel, and this is important, for the first time, to recognize non-Orthodox streams of Judaism, including Reform conversions. Rabbi Chirlo is considered a leader of the more moderate or liberal line in the religious public in Israel, although he still keeps a great distance from the non-Orthodox streams of Judaism whenever he can. In America, in institutional news, the Isabella Friedman Jewish Retreat Center and the organization Chazon are merging. The nonprofits made the announcement last week after discussing the merger since the beginning of 2012. The new entity will be called Chazon. David Weisberg, executive director of Isabella Friedman, will be the merged organization's CEO, and Chazon founder Nigel Savage, a past guest of Too Jewish with the best Jewish name I know, will serve as president. Weisberg said the groups are joining to reach a broader audience. Both work to impact the Jewish food and environmental movements. Chazon has had a huge impact on people's lives, has been at the forefront of reconnecting American Jews with the natural world, but has lacked its own physical base, Weisberg said. This merger is intended to bring more people to the existing Friedman Retreat Center site and enable us together to have a greater impact across the country. We're excited that the merged entity will have a wide range of programs, great staff and volunteers in California, Colorado, and elsewhere, and the opportunity to grow strongly in the future. Chazon will have headquarters in Falls Village, Connecticut, and New York, along with offices in Colorado and California. The Friedman Center, which is part of the UJA Federation of New York, will keep its name and become a sub-brand. Other sub-brands will be Adama, their farming program, the spirituality-based Eilat Chaim Retreats, the Jew and the Carrot Food Blog, the Jewish Greening Fellowship, Makom Chadash Support Group, the Shemitah Project, a joint venture of Chazon and the Jewish Farm School, Siach, an international Jewry program, and Teva, an environmental education program. Nigel Savage said the merger reflects a growing interest in the food and the environment within the Jewish community, and the merger will aim to achieve a more sustainable world. And finally, one Jewish baseball note. Former Boston Red Sox and Chicago White Sox third baseman Kevin Youkilis, who was Jewish, descended from Romanian Jewish immigrants, has signed a one-year deal with the New York Yankees to play next year for $12 million. That reminds us of this classic rant by comedian and actor Dennis Leary about Kevin Youkilis, which came out not long after Mel Gibson's drunken anti-Semitic comments put that actor into rehab.
No. Maybe he's
Jewish.
I think he's Jewish. Yes.
Oh, really?
He's
Jewish? Yeah. Oh, good. That's great.
That's fantastic.
We've got Jewish Texas.
That's one bottle of whiskey away from being an Irish Catholic.
Right.
You know? They got the Manischewitz. We got the Jamesons. You know? It's the same guilt, the same bad food. That's fantastic. We got a Jewish first baseman. I didn't know that.
Right.
This is fabulous.
We got a Jewish first baseman, and Javi will be behind the plate.
Javi Lopez.
Yeah, not tonight. We got Mirabelli back.
Javi Lopez.
Well, I like you.
I'm so proud to have a Jewish first. I didn't
so
even.
So am I. I hope Mel Gibson doesn't come into this park. We'll run him out of here on a rail. Get it?
Nice. Yeah, where's Mel Gibson now? Where's Mel Gibson now? Huh? He's in rehab, and Euclid is at first base. All right, Mel? You happy, Braveheart? Huh? Did you see that grab, Mel? Huh?
I hope in rehab they're showing a replay of that. Yeah. The Jewish first baseman makes the play, Mel Gibson.
He'll be out.
Good luck when you come out.
He'll be shooting. Howard,
call Jeffrey Katzenberg and ask him for a job when you get out, Mel.
The Jewish first baseman. And
I want a whole Jewish infield when Mel Gibson comes out.
That's right.
Bring back Sandy Koufax, Mel Gibson, huh?
Right. That's what they ought to do.
Atta boy, Kev.
They ought to let Sandy Koufax pitch at Mel's head.
That's right.
Fix him.
That should be his community service. Get in the box. Sandy Koufax is going to pitch. Guess who's at first? Kevin Youkilis.
Now, what other Jewish players are there? Because I'm not aware.
Gabe Kapler, I think.
Gabe Kapler. We got two Jews on this team, Mel. Where's your father now, Mel, huh?
Yeah. How about that, Mel?
What a great clip from Dennis Leary. Actually, at one point, the Red Sox had three Jewish ballplayers on the field at the same time, way back in 2005, when outfielder Gabe Kapler and Youkilis were joined by Adam Stern. That was the most in American League baseball history, three Jews. Apparently, four Jews once played for the New York Giants at the same time. Anyway, Youkilis will now be playing in New York, the most Jewish city in America. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Maria Chudnovsky. She's a recipient of the 2012 MacArthur Fellowship, a professor at Columbia University. She has been involved in the development of strong perfect graph theorem. In 2002, she was an integral part of that team, which helps explain how to most efficiently set up cell phone networks, airline scheduling, package delivery systems, and many other things. Born in Russia and raised in Israel, she did her undergraduate work at the Technion, got her master's at the Technion as well, served in the IDF for 3 years, and came to the U.S. getting her PhD in math from Princeton in 2003. Sorry, it couldn't have been a better university. She's a proud member of both the Columbia Jewish community and the worldwide Jewish science community. Well, that's what it says here. What does that mean?
Well, I think it mostly means that I'm Jewish, and it's an important part of my life. I certainly feel a lot of strong connection both to my roots and to Israel, which is where I grew up. I'm organizing a conference in Israel this summer. That's going to be a blast, I hope.
What prompted your family to leave Russia when they left?
Well, Russia was never a particularly good place for Jews. So, as soon as we could leave, we left.
And what was it like accommodating to Israel? A very different kind of environment, of course.
You know, I must tell you, I was so excited to move to Israel that it didn't occur to me it was supposed to be difficult until after the fact. Now when I tell people, we came to Israel when I was 13, the first thing they say to me is, well, 13 is such a difficult age to move. But sort of didn't really occur to me at the time.
In your work, obviously there's many Jews in academia. Does it make a difference to you with whom you work?
I try to choose my collaborators by how good they're in math.
That's probably a wise choice.
Yeah, I know.
In teaching math, and I assume you still do some teaching and not just pure research, although the MacArthur Fellowship maybe allows you more freedom.
No, I teach three courses a year.
What is your favorite way to explain a mathematics concept? Do you have a particular style of pedagogy that you like?
I try to draw pictures a lot. If I can make a picture of it, I guess because I'm more visual, when there's a picture, it's always easier for me to understand things. So I always draw these pictures that I think are so clear and so illuminating, and then it turns out nobody understands them at all. But that's my style. I draw pictures.
So when you received the MacArthur Fellowship, how did your parents respond?
You know what? I think if there's one person in the world who is happier than I am about this fellowship, that's my parents. Because, to them, their job is now done. I'm good.
You're covered. You're ready.
Yeah. The kid's finally grown up.
Mathematics is a very pure kind of study. Almost everything people think about in terms of academics, if you think about math, you think about, boy, that's something that, yes, of course, you have to know it to do other things. Do you think about it in that way, as sort of pure theory?
Well, I think of it as pure theory But I don't think of it as, you know, that thing you need to know to do other things. To me, there's kind of a lot of internal beauty to it, and a lot is going on. And I guess I don't see it as a contradiction to think of something as a pure theory and to think of something as being beautiful in itself.
What attracted you to math in the first place?
Well, in addition to being really bad in all other subjects, you can really make things clear in math. You know, you can really tell, is this true or is this false? Is this correct or is this incorrect? For example, in physics, you know, in order to solve the problem correctly, you need to know something about the world. You need to know there's friction. You need to know, you know, there's gravity. And if you don't know that, then you can, and sort of, in physics, you never know if maybe you forgot an assumption because there's some factor about the world that you forgot to think about. In math, you can really tell if what you did is correct or not. To me, that was always very attractive.
You know, I love the story about Einstein, who, of course, was a theoretical physicist, not a mathematician, but what he was doing just before he died and what he did constantly was math and calculations, trying to prove what he could prove.
Well, I think the line between theoretical physics and math is somewhat blurry.
Do you think that graph theory will end up being where you continue to work, or are you going to go into different areas?
You know, I'm only 35 years old. It's hard to say, but probably chances are that's going to be what I'm going to do.
Are there any stipulations with a MacArthur grant? Can you do anything you want intellectually?
No strings attached. They don't even want to report.
It would be nice if everything in life worked that way.
I know, right?
So what are you going to do?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm going to continue doing math, basically. Specifically, I don't really have specific plans. Do what I do, and you know, maybe it will be a little bit less scary in the next couple of years. Trying to go where nobody has been is always very scary. You need a lot of confidence. Getting such amazing recognition gives you that little bit of confidence that maybe would push you to try and do the next thing.
To advance the frontiers of knowledge without regard to whether it turns out to be the right direction.
To take some chances you couldn't change.
Well, if
change
you advance otherwise. Them, it's the right direction, right?
Exactly. Well, they always say that, you know, experiments prove a theory. Either they prove it right or they prove it wrong. So you learn something
exactly.
Either way.
Yep, that's right.
What goals do you have, personally and professionally? This is sort of scary. Well, this is sort of a rabbi question, you know. So what do you want to do in life?
I want to be happy. I don't know if it's an okay answer to a rabbi,
I think it's a good answer.
I think that's really my main goal.
It's a good answer.
Probably to be that, you know, I'll need to be happy with my work, and I'll need to be happy with my family and, you know, various things. But basically, as long as the balance is such that I'm happy, I'm good.
You have compared doing math to doing a crossword puzzle because you can know what you did, whether what you did is right or wrong. Are there areas of math where it isn't so clear?
I don't think so, actually. I mean, sort of, you need to have some understanding of the area. For example, I was just now trying to read a paper, which is not in my area, but I was interested in the result, and it was just so frustrating because it was like reading in a different language. I had no idea what they were doing. So, but that's because I was lacking certain knowledge. If I opened the right books and I read, I read their background, I could have known what was going on, and I could have told if it was right or wrong. So I think in math, as long as kind of you study the right things, you know.
I want to thank Maria Chudnovsky for a great visit here on Too Jewish, wish her continued success, and may the MacArthur Fellowship lead to even more and greater things.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock when our guest will be a personal favorite, Jeremy Cowan, founder and president of Schmaltz Brewing Company, creator of the delicious and entertaining Hebrew beer, now enjoying its post-bar mitzvah year, L'chaim. Our playout this morning comes from an alumni group of the Yeshiva University a cappella group, the Maccabees. The Maccabees themselves had a viral video the last couple of Hanukkahs with their candlelight parody. This one is called Eight Nights. It parodies a group called Fun, whose lead singer really is Jewish. Anyway, I really promise it's the last of our Hanukkah cuts for 5773. My friends, have an end of Chag Hanukkah Sameach, a happy, healthy, and delightful conclusion to this festival of lights, and may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Eight nights I stay up staring at those candles. They tell the story that occurred. Eight nights we're thankful for that small miracle. Our prayers are answered and our voices heard. When one night turns eight, that's why we celebrate. In the dark of night, the candles stand for all. The candles stand for, the candles stand for.
Eight nights that we know.
Cause it's finally.